We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. At the controls this morning, this hour, Jason Croft, Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Harriet Williamson is our producer. We're happy to have back here on the program once again Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at the University of Illinois, and he is a photographer, and he teaches photojournalism, was for many years a photographer for the News Gazette newspaper. So he's a guy who's been dealing with photography for a long time, both doing it himself and teaching others how to do it. And for a while now, every once in a while, he is on the program and we talk about cameras and photography. And for at one point, we used to talk about film.
I know. I was just sorting through some old boxes and I decided that it was my historical duty to save some film so I could show students in the future.
And they'd say, gee, Pops, what's that?
Oh, it's crazy.
So let me tell you, kid, there used to be this thing we call film, and we had a dark room.
And I had developing reels and, you know, all of that I was putting away. It's time marches on, but I'm not really necessarily that sorry to see film go. And thankfully, the cameras we have now are of such a quality that I think really photography in the last, 10, 15 years has really blossomed because of digital photography coming on.
Well, I just was thinking the other day, the other night, I happened to be in a local big box store, and I wandered by where they have the cameras. And there was a stunning array of cameras. Almost all of them you could put in your pocket.
Right.
So it gives people the chance to – and then if you have – well, he's got his iPad in front of him. You have a computer. You have access to all kinds of tools for – manipulating the images. So it puts, it's like you don't have to have a dark room anymore. And here's, he's got a camera he just pulled out of his
pocket. Pulled that out of my pocket, I know.
So it's for a very small amount of money, you can have a very sophisticated pocket-sized camera. You can mess around with the images and
the
really
key
easy.
Thing, and this has always been true going back, to film, really, but the camera you have with you is better than the camera you don't have
with
you.
That's what I was saying. The best camera is the one that you have.
Yeah, because, even with the iPad, I've shot pictures using the iPad because I had it with me and there's, cat sleeping in a cute way or something. And I shot pictures of it. And it's like, capturing the moment has always been the strength of photography. And if you have a camera with you to capture that moment, that quality is better than not capturing that moment at all.
Yeah. So it's just, it's amazing how easy and how affordable tools are, good tools. You take a little time maybe to learn how to use them.
But, sure.
And
the thing is, it's just like any other tool, though. I mean, you can have a beautiful hammer and not know how to, build a bookcase, not how to build a boat. So just because you have the tool doesn't mean you can produce something interesting with it.
The other thing, I promise I have callers here I get to. The other thing I was thinking of, I was wondering now how many pictures that are taken now are ever actually printed.
Right. Right.
Which, I don't know that that's a particular issue, but
it's an interesting issue, and it's interesting to think about, though, how many pictures were taken with film, even though they were printed, are sitting in a drawer somewhere. So even though a picture's not printed, our options for viewing those images are so much broader now that even though they're not printed, the ability to see them with ease is probably greater now. So so it's an interesting sort of shift in our paradigm.
Well, we have a couple callers here. We'll get right to them. They both happen to be in Indiana. So we'll start in with somebody in Lafayette on our line 4, toll-free line right here. Hello.
Hello. I've seen several times on television master photographers using something called night vision. What is that?
Right. So it's usually a lens, or it could be you know, built into the camera as well. But it's a light amplification lens or device. And so what it does is it takes the small amount of either visual light, or it might combine it with infrared a little bit, and it just magnifies that little bit of light multiple times so that you can actually see what's there. It's the same technology that's used in night vision goggles that the military uses.
I noticed that, the same dark green.
Right.
Sort of.
Right, yeah. And, you know, many, many years ago, I remember one of the, you know, well-known camera manufacturers had a night vision lens. And you know, this was back in the 80s, I think, and it was something, you know, like $60,000 or something for that lens. I'm sure it's come down quite a bit since then. But, yeah, but that's what it's doing. It's taking the little bit of light that's available, and it amplifies and multiplies that light many times.
So it's not a light itself.
Right.
It merely amplifies.
Right. Although, you know, even back, you know, during World War II, what people would do is they would shoot with infrared film, and then they would have an infrared flash bulb. It was basically a flash bulb that had a very, you know, red color to it. And because that light is just on the very edge of the visual spectrum, you could take light, you could take infrared film and infrared flash and take pictures where there was almost no light. There's a story of Eugene Smith, who was out taking pictures during World War II of a battle. And even though there wasn't much light that flashed with infrared, he didn't want to take any pictures of the battle at night, because even that little bit of a flash that you could see, he didn't want to have it give away the location of the troops.
Well, thanks very much, sir.
Sure. All right, thank you. Over to another Indiana caller here. This is line one. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I wondered if you could give me sort of a short intro into buying the proper camera, and mainly the number of megapixels. It would be used for photographing paintings.
Okay.
Then they would be printed. I was trying to find this print I had done. Fella got runs a gallery, and he's got a print machine he brought in. It cost him, I think, 13 pow. And he used one of my paintings to check it out, because I use a lot of colors from one spectrum to the other. And I don't have a camera, but it's now to the place where if you don't have a website with digital photographs,
right,
you can sort of forget about
right,
selling,
right,
unfortunately. So I need an idea about, you know, that sort of the top end camera with how many megapixels versus, you know, the ones you just shoot
right
from the hip.
Right. You know what's interesting is that the megapixel wars are over a little bit, and mm-hmm. it was a little bit of marketing hype.
Yeah.
While you can fit a lot of megapixels onto a chip that's smaller than your pinky fingernail, you know, it's
yeah.
like really small. What the better cameras have is they might not have any more megapixels necessarily, but each of those pixels is larger, and with a larger pixel, it allows that image to be captured with greater color fidelity and less noise. So, partly what you're looking for is a camera that has a larger image sensor. Before I came over today, I was noticing that a lot of the manufacturers are making smaller cameras that have a larger chip in them. So sometimes it's a little bit difficult to look in the specifications to see how large.
They almost seem to hide it from you in the box store.
Yeah, it's really hard to find, because it's easy to just put up a megapixel count and see. But if you go online, if you go to, you know, the usa.canon.com, and I think Nikon's is usa.nikon.com. Pentax has one out. Panasonic has one out. There are a couple different styles or specifications of cameras. One is called Micro Four Thirds, and you know, that has a slightly larger chip. Then there's another chip size that sometimes is called APS-C. You know, normally the cameras that are going to be more of a typical DSLR camera, if they're in usually the, you know, $500 to $5,000 price range is where you're going to get the larger size chips.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Okay. Very good. Thank you. Well, we'll go on again to Champagne and line number two. Hello.
Hi. So actually, you missed the days back in film when you took the pictures and then you developed them and discovered you didn't get that shot.
Yeah, I love that. That was great. And then I also loved when you'd find out that you had the wrong shutter speed set for your flash,
mm-hmm.
and you'd only get half of a picture. Those were those are really wonderful days.
You don't go back to the day of the speed graphic, though, right?
I don't go back that far, although I've handled a speed graphic. I've used a 4x5 camera before, so I know all about, putting your film holder in and pulling the dark slide out and all
that. Or forgetting
to
do it.
Yeah, or forgetting to do it, exactly. And you don't have any way to know. Or you forget. Now, if you didn't flip the slide back in the right way, you had to figure out, did I shoot this particular negative, or is it still, you know, a fresh negative I can shoot on? So.
it was the black side. You were supposed to turn them to show that you'd shot them.
Yeah, I could never decide if I wanted to use the black side or the white side, so.
in terms of my only comment with the, also the other one in terms of black and white, some of those, I know that I used to be in Chicago, and there's a creative director that his hobby was photography, but he did black and white. It was just absolutely beautiful.
Sure.
The only criticism I have with the digital is that I know this individual, every time takes a trip, takes 1,000 pictures, and I think she's up to 10,000 or something or other. And I, you know, in terms of composition, all that other kind of stuff, rather than think the picture through, they just shoot.
Right.
It becomes like a movie.
Right. No, you know, and it's the classic case of a double-edged sword, where being able to take pictures easily and quickly and inexpensively sometimes gives people the false sense that, well, if I only just shoot more pictures, that I'll be lucky and get one, rather than, as you say, spending the time to ask yourself, okay, I want to take a picture. Why do I want to take this picture? What is there about this scene or the situation that I'm seeing really attracts me? Is it the light? Is it the color? Is it the location? Is there a moment going on? You know, and then taking that information and saying, okay, what's the best way to illustrate that? So you're absolutely right that it's easy to think, well, I've got this equipment, it's easy to use, I'm now a photographer, when really, it's what the photographer brings to that in the sense of their creativity and intellect that makes the image.
Well, at least the professional photographer lives on.
Yeah, that's right.
Good program.
Thanks for the call. The point of all this is that the nice thing about the digital camera is that right away you can look at the picture. You don't have to wait to see.
Which is amazing. And in fact, in the kind of the middle ages of photojournalism with digital cameras, there was a term that was developed that was called chimping. And what that was is every time you would take a picture, you'd turn the camera so you could look at the little screen and you'd go, ooh, look at this picture I got. And so people called it chimping.
Chimping, I like
and
that a lot.
I think that's funny. You know, so it is a really wonderful thing. And in fact, some of my friends that are still out with an active freelance career in photography, it was interesting because I, you know, talked about this mindset of taking a lot of photos. Now, here's one thing that they said that was a real eye-opener for me, and given the story I'm going to tell, it's kind of a pun. But my friend would say, you know, I would lose every now and then just enough pictures by people blinking that it drove me nuts. So what I would do is every time I take a picture of someone, I take three in a row. And he said, that way I always get one where they're not blinking. Mm-hmm. And so that's a case where you don't think of the inherent, aspect of the technology being something that could be a negative thing, but you could use as a positive angle where you can shoot several in a row to try to get that shot.
Yeah. Okay. Our guest this morning in this hour is Brian Johnson. He teaches journalism at the U of I, photojournalism, and was a newspaper photographer and still takes a lot of pictures. And over the years has been with us on a pretty regular basis to talk about photography. As we have changed from the day when we were talking about film to now pretty much what we're talking about is digital. But whatever you do, if you got questions, film, digital,
yeah,
whatever, give us a call.
You know, or even if people are shooting video, you know, happy to answer questions about that.
All right. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. And here's another caller in Ivesdale, line three.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi.
Well, you sound like the man to ask this question. I just briefly, I you know, I'm a little bit older. I used to use film cameras, I like the little Instamatic 110s and that. And anyways, I never got into real technical cameras in the film days. But I now have a digital camera, of course, and I've taken, my wife says I have a good eye. I take pictures occasionally, and as I get older, I have more time because I can't do much. But I post my pictures on a particular website, and I've actually got number one news photo of the day and things like that.
Great.
And, you know, I've got some pretty neat pictures, and I love sharing because I was blessed enough to see something, and I can share with others. But my question is, and maybe you can steer me in the right direction, my wife's, I suppose it would be my deceased father-in-law, my wife's dad, he's passed away for, you know, quite some time ago, but he had a very high-end 35-millimeter camera, and I can't tell you the brand name, and I have to dig it out. He's got a lot of telephoto lenses or whatever you call
sure.
them. I don't know anything about that stuff. And my question is, I absolutely want to learn how to operate this camera, and I want to take it in and have it basically somewhere. I don't know where to give it a tune-up and learn how to use it and learn what the different lenses are for. Can you steer me in the right direction on that?
Sure.
I'm not...
Yeah, so I'm thinking that, it, you know, clearly you said it's a 35-millimeter camera. One of the things that you'll want to think about from the beginning is once you shoot, well, one, finding someone that's still selling film that you can get to easily shouldn't be that big of a deal. Two, you know, where to get the film processed.
Sure.
And, you know, can you get it, you know, printed easily so you can take a look at the images, and then
are there places available that even I
sure
can do?
yeah I mean, I don't think that'll be really that big of a deal, but you know, just want to check in your normal you know, normal day when you're out and about if there's a place that you can, you know, take things to or send it to, and then think about the expense of it too. Excuse
me. I understand
that. Yeah, so I think it's a great, you know, I think it's a great idea to want to, you know, learn to use the camera and use the tools that are there. And it's kind of one of the great tragedies, I think, as we've moved to digital, is that there, myself included, there are many people that have these really great cameras out there that, you know, aren't as usable as they were just because of the difficulty of, you know, shooting film and getting it processed. So I guess what I would say is definitely go ahead and, you know, get some film and shoot it. When you're doing that, though, I would suggest that you try to keep notes of what your settings were.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that if, you know, if you take...
I can adjust from there.
Yeah, you know, and so when you get your pictures back, you can say, okay, I shot this picture at, you know, 1/250th of a second at 5.6, and, you know, the background isn't as sharp as I'd like to... like it to be, or, you know, maybe you were taking pictures of a car racing by and it wasn't quite, you know, frozen in action as much as you'd like it to be. So
basically just jump into it and start trying it and learn from experience.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's it. You know, I bet if how to use the camera doesn't make sense from looking at it. It's pretty amazing that a lot of the owner's manuals for cameras are online. In the 35 millimeter days, a lot of the, you know, basically the camera interface, let's say, you know, the shutter button, the shutter speeds, the apertures, that was fairly standardized. So you could go online or, you know, get a photography book and have pretty good chances.
I didn't think about that, looking for an owner's manual online.
Right.
That would be, there's probably one floating around there somewhere.
I bet there is, exactly. So,
one's missing, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, you know, and as I say, you know, most of the cameras in that time were pretty standardized as far as here's the shutter speed dial, here's the aperture, so that really any kind of photography book that you'd pick up that addresses using film cameras, and there are tons and tons of books out there that do that.
Okay.
I think that'd be a good place to start.
Okay, great. Yeah, I'm just in the beginning of thinking about using this. Well, I've been wanting to, and I'm looking like I'm beginning to get the time and the strength back in my arms. I may be able to hold a camera. And so I want to have a nice hobby with that.
Sure,
and
yeah.
So rare to, it's just, I think it's just classic to shoot with a 35 millimeter. I would absolutely love to learn it. So,
right.
Wonderful. I appreciate the advice, and you got me steered in the right direction.
Okay, very good.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a great day.
You too.
If, you know, supposing someone had a good high-end film camera, one of the kind that had adjustable lenses and they had collection lenses.
Sure.
Can that be converted to a digital camera? Can you put a digital back on it or something?
Well, there are some, the answer is yes, sort of. You know, there were some medium format professional cameras where they had interchangeable backs and you could, you know, get a digital back for it. That's sort of how we morphed into completely digital cameras. Most of the 35 millimeters, not so much. I know with, for a long, long time, Nikon was always proud that even their older lenses could be used on the newer cameras.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens is there's a lot of intelligence built into the lens itself in a modern lens. And so while an older lens might fit on the new cameras, you lose a lot of the technical advantages that come with the new technology in that lens. So while it might be possible, it is to varying degrees successful. With some manufacturers, the camera mount itself is not consistent, so you can't even use it.
Okay. Well, other questions are welcome. In fact, we have a number of people here standing by ready to go. And we will go next to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Okay, hello.
Yeah, hi.
Yeah, hi. I wonder, my family was really into photography, and recently I found an old Kodak, I believe it was a Model B from 1927.
Uh-huh.
And I think it shot 144 millimeter film. Do you know anything about those cameras?
Wow.
It was called a pocket model. It kind of unfolds, and it has the leather, you know, accordion that opens up and the whole bit.
So you say it's a Model B, right?
Yeah, I believe it was a Model B or a Model 2. I don't have it with me right now. And I remember looking through some old pictures, I would find these little photographs, maybe an inch and a half by an inch and a half.
Right.
Does anybody even produce that film anymore?
Well, there are some. I don't know how, you know, ready a lot of the more unusual sizes are. I haven't checked into that recently. There had been some custom film makers that would actually cut existing film to the size. I'm looking online here at a Kodak Model B. It's the number 4 folding pocket camera Model B. That says it uses 123 size film.
Yeah, it's not the same camera, but it sounds close.
Yeah, so let me go back here. And let's see if I can get that in. You know, 123 film was actually, you know, fairly popular. So I would think you'd have a, you know, fairly good chance.
Okay.
Yes.
need to look around and see what I can find online.
It looks like, you know, I'm looking here for, you know, Model 2, you know, some take 127 size film, some take 122 size film. You know, if it's like a number 2 Brownie camera and it takes 120 size film, that would actually be pretty good because 120 size film was a film format that is still used today. 127, you know, film, if it takes that size, you know, that was fairly common also.
I wish I had I even printed a manual they had online, which was kind of neat because it's kind of a strange camera to use.
Right.
And so it was just kind of neat. Also, my dad from World War II brought back, it was a, I think he told me that it was a, the German division of Polaroid. It was ANSI or something like
that.
Yeah,
there's a company called ANSCO.
Yeah, and apparently it supposedly had one of the best lenses, but I don't know if that.
Yeah, I mean, there's also the Leica cameras that, you know, a lot of the GIs brought back from World War II.
Right.
So I don't know if it's a Leica camera or not. If it is a Leica, you know, you're in luck because, you know, Leica cameras are extremely well built and extremely valuable.
Right. Yeah, I remember I took it to a camera shop to get cleaned up, and the guy, I can't even remember now what he offered me, but he was all excited about it, and but I wanted to keep it to shoot photographs.
Sure,
it, so.
Sure. You know, not to in any way get your hopes up, because I doubt if it's the same camera, but I was just reading today that one of the very first Leica cameras, it was before they were available to the public. There were only like 25 made, but it sold for $1.9 million. So.
I know it's not that one.
Okay.
My son's fortunately fascinated by this, so. Anyway, I appreciate the information. I don't want to tie up the line too long, but I've enjoyed listening to you.
Sure, great. Well, thanks for the call. Okay, we'll go on and go to another Champagne person. This is line number 2. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I yesterday took my camera out of my car, the nice air conditioning in my car, and went out into this heat. And I got condensation on my lenses. And I was wondering a couple things about that. Is it bad for my lenses? How can I prevent it? And once if it happens again, how do I fix it so that I can use the lenses somewhat soon?
Right, right. Yesterday was a particularly unusual day in that it was so hot and so humid. I know when I walked outside, my sunglasses fogged up really extensively. Well, one thing you can do is hope that you're not in a hurry, because if you can put your camera in a Ziploc bag and take it outside, then the condensation will form on the Ziploc bag itself. Mm-hmm. And if you have enough time outside then for your camera to warm up to the ambient temperature, that will stop the fogging issue.
Okay.
It used to be really fun as a photojournalist in the wintertime when it was swimming season. And, you know, have your camera in the car at 30 degrees and then walk into this natatorium with, you know, 100% humidity. And that was always a challenge. But usually the thing is you know, getting the camera to the same temperature as where you're shooting. So the Ziploc bag trick works, but it does take a little while to warm it up. You know, I suppose the other thing you could do is, you know, try to warm the camera up yourself. I mean, you could, you know, warm it up in your hands maybe a little bit first or something like that. So when you took it outside, it was already, you know, at a warmer temperature.
Okay.
And then
go ahead.
Well, all I was going to say then, you know, you'd ask also, you know, is it bad for your cameras and the lenses? It can be if the condensation gets, you know, inside the camera. And so some of that, you know, most of the cameras are fairly well sealed. So I guess that would be a little bit of a concern that, you know, if it happens on a regular basis, you definitely would want to get in the habit of using the plastic bag trick.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, we're talking this morning with Brian Johnson. He's professor of journalism at U of I. We're talking about cameras and photography. And we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Dr. Paul Farmer has spent 30 years treating the poor in Haiti, Rwanda, Russia, and elsewhere. He was appointed the UN Deputy Special Envoy to Haiti.
One thing we have to acknowledge is that if you look at Haiti, many billions of dollars have gone into development aid there that have not been effective.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Farmer. His new book is Haiti After the Earthquake. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here with different topics throughout the week. Tomorrow morning, it is the morning of the month that we usually talk about nutrition. Usually the guest is a certified nutritionist, Susan Kundrat. Now, she's not able to be with us this time around. Celeste Quinn will be hosting the show, and she'll be talking with Linda Watson. She's a cook and a researcher and author of the book Wildly Affordable Organic, Eat Fabulous Food, Get Healthy, and Save the Planet, all on $5 a day or less. That's tomorrow at 10. Then tomorrow morning in the 11 o'clock hour, we'll talk a little bit about the history of the Wailers, that band that we associate with Bob Marley. Our guest will be Colin Grant. He's an historian and producer for the BBC and has written a book that's titled The Natural Mystics. That's about Bob Marley, but also about two other men that were very important in this band, Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer. So that's tomorrow at 11. Then Thursday at 10, we will look back to the Upper Big Branch Mine explosion. That happened in the spring of last year. And recently there have been some results of some reports coming out talking about just who was responsible. And we'll talk about failures all the way around in terms of inspection and in terms of the people who ran the mine. And our guest for that will be Celeste Monforton from George Washington University. We're here weekday mornings, 10 until noon. You can look at the schedule by going to our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. You can also listen to some past programs that you might have missed first time around. In this hour of Focus, we're talking about photography. Brian Johnson is our guest. He's professor of journalism at U of I. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email if you like, and we have a couple here. We'll try to get them all in. Address is will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go back to the phones here for next for someone in Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I have to apologize. I had a phone conversation that kept me away from the program. I was wondering what your students are using now. I remember a few years ago, I think they were using the Canon SX10.
Right. So the students in our journalism program right now are using the Canon SX30. The class now is essentially a multimedia class. You know, really, photojournalism today is multimedia. And what's really nice about the SX, you know, SX5, SX10, SX20, SX30 is that they're reasonably priced. They have an articulated screen so you can, you know, rotate it around and you can, you know, see what you're looking at from a number of angles. It does a decent job with shooting video, and it has a, you know, reasonable zoom lens on it. So if you need to shoot something outside and get in close, you can still do it.
I have the SX20, and I like it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's been a fairly popular camera, that whole series. And I know when people outside of students, or, you know, students too, but clearly other colleagues of mine that have used it have all been really happy with the results and really happy with the camera itself.
And I have a follow-up question. It seems to me that the Canon camera makers keep pushing the number of megapixels up on the microprocessors, and that seems to increase the noise, to me, excessively.
Right.
Do you have any noise suppression software that you would recommend, and will it really materially help?
Yeah, there are some companies out there. There's one software package that I'd use that's called Noise Ninja.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah, and it was nice because you could use it as a plug-in with Photoshop, and it really did an amazing job removing the noise in a way that didn't destroy the image, but really reduce that level of noise.
Have your students tried the Canon Hack Developer's Kit? It's supposedly, in fact, on the 20, it did initially let me shoot in RAW format. The upgrade seems to have destroyed that.
Right. Yeah. So what he's talking about, there was a way to get into the camera, because right now many of the lower-end cameras, they just shoot in, give you a JPEG image. There's a format called RAW that basically gives you all the information that the sensor records. And there's a way to adjust the software of the camera so that it would give you a RAW image. And I haven't fooled with that at all, just because, like you say, you know, you get the new firmware update and it's not there. But if I think it's a great thing if you have, you know, a little bit of time to do that and experiment with it. Absolutely.
Well, thanks so much. I'll have to try. It's Noise Ninja.
Noise Ninja. Yeah, I'm just looking online to see if they're still out there.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Mike.
Well, that again, just to underscore something you said earlier, that I'm sure when people are looking at cameras, one of the first things they're going to look at in terms of its specifications is how many megapixels it has.
Right.
So it seems like we went like 4, 8, 10, 12, 14, I don't know how high it goes. And now I think actually even I've seen on cameras, they seem to be actually backing back
right
down on megapixels. And what you said, the important thing you really would like to know about is the image sensor. How big
right
is that?
Right. And that's, you know, and that's part of the reason that they're starting to back off of that was, as the previous caller said, you know, you can have 15 million pixels on this chip, but there's a lot of noise, a lot of, you know, graininess, you might call it, with that image. So, and especially in lower light levels. So what the manufacturers are now is like, well, gosh, we're all at 12 megapixels. There's not much more to be gained there. So now we're going to start to talk about the effectiveness of our camera shooting in low light, you know, and reducing the noise and getting, you know, better battery life. So they've, you know, shifted their marketing into that, and not just the marketing, but also the manufacture, that it isn't just the megapixels, it's the quality of the image sensor.
Yeah. Probably a lot of pictures that they take are going to be taken indoors, and chances are those are going to be low light conditions.
You know, and it's true, and it's, you know, you can shoot without a flash inside, and that's usually what I have my students do because it's less obtrusive. But there are times that you need to use flash. So that's something else to consider. You know, how effective is the flash at lighting the scene when you're shooting indoors? One of the things that's kind of neat with some of the cell phone cameras is that they have an itty-bitty little LED flash, and even better than that, some of them now are coming with two LED flashes, one on one side of the lens and another one on the other side. So so instead of getting that sort of shadow outline of the person on the wall that you would get with just one flash, having a flash kind of on either side helps.
Gives you a little fill light.
Exactly. It's more of a front light. You know, it gives you, you know, light that's even on both sides.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we got some other callers here. We've got 10 minutes left, so we'll keep on going and talk next with someone in Champaign County here, line one. Hello.
Hi. On that last subject, can you name names? Who has two LEDs on their flash on the phone? I'm up for a phone upgrade or something, so who does that?
And I'm going to have to look up. I'm a big Apple fanboy, and so some of the rumors were that the new iPhone was going to come with a dual LED flash.
Okay.
So I don't know what other manufacturers have it. I think it'd be probably a fairly easy search.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What I was going to ask about was like aperture, and I think the other one is LightWave. What other things that fit in before Photoshop, what do you have to say about those? And then the other thing, aren't there two different charge coupling device techniques?
Right.
Can you say anything that would help us make sense about a camera choice in the future about that? Or?
Sure. So the first technology was called CCD, which was charge coupled device. And then there's another image sensor variety that came along that was called CMOS, which is complementary metal oxide semiconductor. So what you're seeing now is a lot of the manufacturers, the CMOS technology is coming around where they can manufacture them, you know, relatively inexpensively. The CMOS sensors use less energy, and if they're engineered well, they can also give you a better, lower noise image. So, I guess I've, for many years now, kind of been sold on the CMOS technology, and it's making its way into less expensive cameras now. So, it isn't a huge thing. I mean, really, I like to recommend that people look at the camera they're thinking of buying in a holistic fashion. You know, you look at the menu structure of the camera. You look at how it feels in your hands. You, think about things like the size of it and, you know, what kind of strap does it have on it and, how much does the lens zoom in and out and is that something that you care about? So, yes, the sensor technology is a really crucial point. And as long as it's taken in the context of the whole camera, I think it's one wise thing to be thinking about and looking at.
The other part was about aperture and LightWave.
Yeah, so I'm a big aperture fan. Aperture is aperture and Lightroom are two programs that they're a little bit different from Photoshop in that Photoshop is, it's a program where you can work with images and you can composite images and do all kinds of cool things. With Lightroom and Aperture both, one of the great things that they've added is a way to catalog and organize and store your images. One of the reasons that I like Aperture is that they've added quite a number of image adjusting features into it. So I'm a real Aperture fan because you can use the one program to catalog your images, but also adjust them as you need to be able to use them. So I'm a big Aperture fan.
Well, I hope that helps. I want to make sure I have a couple of emails here I'd like to get in. We have someone here who writes, I just bought a Sony Handycam camcorder. Mm-hmm. He says, I was surprised to find that when I hooked it up to my laptop, it just didn't play. He says, that makes me worry. He says, I'm sure after I read the manual, I'll know what I need to do to get it to play on my computer. But what about editing what I've recorded into something more presentable, maybe stitching together several runs and excising those that were unusable? Is there good freeware available to do that?
Sure. There are packages for both Mac and PC. When you get a Mac, it comes with iMovie software. With a lot of PCs, there's Microsoft Movie Maker and packages like that. One thing that's happened in the video world is that when a camera shoots video, it takes that image and uses what's called a codec. That stands for compressor decompressor to take that image, squish it down so that you can store a lot of video on your chip or on your tape. Then what happens though is then when you play it on your computer, you need to have a matching codec that will take that data and expand it back into a playable form. There's a variety of, there's an alphabet soup of codecs out there. There's AVC HD. And that seems like it's been a fairly popular one. So what you need to do is, as far as playing it back, is you need to be sure that your player can play back that codec. And if it can't directly, if you can get a plugin so that you can, you know, say, okay, you need this software to, you know, open up this video. So you sometimes you have to pay $20 to buy the codec and plug it in.
All right. Hopefully that helps. Someone also writes, I have a Panasonic Luminous camera that I love. I've dropped it too many times, and the lens won't move now, so the camera won't come on,
right,
and the lens is stuck.
Right.
Is there anyone who can work on it?
Yeah. You know, normally what I do is I'll send it back to the manufacturer. There are a number of, you know, independent people that'll, you know, fix cameras out there. I just sent one of my cameras off to a place down in Texas. And having the lens get stuck, just like you've described, is one of the most common ways that the cameras get broken, basically, because in the lenses, there are a series of helicoid gears that go all the way around the lens. If it gets bumped, those gears go out of alignment and they kind of lock up. And there's nothing for the user to be able to do, really, to fix that. It needs to be sent in. it seems that almost any basic camera repair is going to be in the $90 to $120 range. So what happens with a lot of people, depending upon the price of the camera and how long they've had it, instead of getting the older camera fixed, in our throwaway society, we
just got to get a new one.
Buy a new one. Yeah. And along with that, get all the new features that might be available on it.
Okay. Well, we have about 5 minutes. We have some other callers. Terre Haute next, line four. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for the program. Sure. Very interesting, as always. I've never done a video, but I think I'm about ready to get a video camcorder. But because of my ignorance of the whole thing, I'm not quite sure how far to jump in. I'm thinking around $400 or $500. Could you get something worthwhile for that? And I would say, because I take it on travels a lot, lightness is a must.
Sure.
Will those small? I see those very small cameras. They claim they have something like digital stabilization.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, I'm always very shaky. With the still cameras. So does any of that work?
Yeah. It absolutely does work. You know, there are two different types of image stabilization. There's electronic stabilization and there's optical image stabilization. The optical image stabilization is better because what it does is, as you're shaking, there's one lens element within the lens that shakes in the opposite directions. And so as you're shaking one way, it's shaking the other, and it basically cancels itself out. As far as the cameras go, given that you said you do a fair amount of traveling, I would buy more of a still camera, because most of the still cameras, you know, starting at $150 on up, have a movie mode or a video mode built in. And what the advantage of that is that then when you're out traveling, you can take still pictures, you can shoot movies all with the same camera. So that's normally what I recommend people do. That's what I do myself. I take a still camera that can also shoot video, and I just, you know, shoot stills or video depending upon what the content is.
That's a tough call because, you know, I have still camera sitting on the shelf,
right,
used forever. So it seems like I'm buying another still camera.
Yeah. Well, you can check and see if the still camera you have shoots video and if it shoots high quality video. So you definitely could get a camcorder. There are, you know, cameras that's kind of generically called a flip camera that a lot of the manufacturers make that are really simple. But then you're taking two cameras with you, you know, and I think it would be better, instead of spending another, you know, $200, $300, $400 on a video camera that does so-so still pictures, to get still camera that shoots good video.
So the video cameras that advertise extracting a still picture from it, that will be a lower quality still?
Usually the video camera still pictures are of a lower quality than a still camera standalone. So with a point-and-shoot still camera, you get good quality still pictures and good quality video. Quality video that's usually equivalent to what you're going to get with a video-only camera. With the video cameras, they give you equal quality to the point-and-shoots, but the still pictures aren't as good.
And would you say $400 or $500 would buy me a good
one? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're going to...
And fairly light. Is it heavy?
No, in that range, like Canon, for instance, has their digital ELF series. And, Panasonic and Sony, I mean, really all the manufacturers have those smaller point-and-shoot cameras that are small, light. They do video and stills.
I see. Okay, well, that's quite helpful. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. Well, we're at the point here we're going to have to finish. I'm sorry, we got one caller that we can't take. I was kind of surprised we got somebody calls today. That's great.
Yeah.
Sometime you'll come back. I was thinking one of the things I was going to ask you about, since you even brought along your iPad, was maybe to talk about apps, photo photography apps, because there are so many
right.
of them now.
Right, right. And the quick thing is try to shoot your pictures straight and do your adjusting later. So don't take the picture in black and white, take it in color and turn it into black and white.
Well, that's one of the things I want to, because there are cameras that have monochrome
yeah,
setting. You say,
yeah.
take it in color if you
take
want to
it
do
in
it
color.
Later.
Yeah, you can do just okay. about anything later.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
Yeah, great.
That? Brian Johnson, professor of journalism at the University of Illinois. Occasionally he's here. We talk about photography.